proceed straight through the agenda, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 234A. I have six witnesses, all in favor, and I'm going to call the first panel, Wendy Johnson, looks like Kay Garrett, Ronell Schenkel, Shani Ford. You folks want to come forward, please? As I said, I have no opposition noted on the witness registration forms. Ladies?
Good morning, Representative Ackerman, members of the committee. My name is Wendy Johnson. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. Senate Bill 234 is the first of three bills today that you will hear that were recommended to the Legislative Assembly this session by the Law Commission. This first bill, Senate Bill 234, came from the Juvenile Code Revision Work Group, a sub-work group of that group, and it was chaired by Katie Garrett, Associate Attorney General, who will be testifying today as well. This bill comes to you from the Commission because there was a gap in the law regarding putative fathers, and putative fathers are alleged biological fathers, but there has not been a determination that these men are indeed the father. In this bill focuses on the juvenile court for the first sections of the bill, and it provides both authority for the juvenile court to determine paternity, and it also clarifies who these putative fathers are and who should be receiving notice and service of summons in these proceedings. Let me explain why the need. In a dependency case, you're dealing with a child who perhaps is involved in an abuse situation or some other reason why the juvenile is before the court. And one of the most likely potential placements of the child would be the father if the child is with the mother at the time. And so if the father is not receiving notice, you've left out a very important link. And so this bill clarifies who the putative father is and requires notice to the father in all of these types of proceedings, including guardianship, permanent guardianship proceedings, termination of parental right proceedings, and other dependency proceedings. So if you look at the bill, the first section defines who a father is. The second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth sections have to do with providing service and party status of these potential fathers. Then Section 7 of the bill just makes Section 8 a part of Chapter 419B, which is the dependency chapter. And then Section 8 is the other portion of the bill I'd like to highlight. That section of the bill allows the juvenile court the authority to determine paternity, because right now when there's a juvenile before the court, they have to both go into juvenile court, and then if there's a paternity dispute, they have to go into circuit court. And so it would be easier for all parties to be able to do it all in one place in front of the juvenile court. The remaining sections of the bill, sections 9 through 23, are sections that were not recommended originally by the Oregon Law Commission but were amended in on the Senate side. They are consensus amendments, but I just need to make clear for the record that these did not go through the Law Commission's process. They involve issues of paternity disestablishment. The Oregon Law Commission will be looking at paternity issues, including the Uniform Parentage Act, in the interim, but these were compromise amendments that were worked out for now in the Senate. They do have sunset provisions as well because of the anticipated Oregon Law Commission project next session. The remaining members of the panel today will talk about those sections 9 through 23. But I'd be happy to answer any questions on the Law Commission's portion, but Katie Garrett and will be able to answer more details on the specific provisions as she chaired this project.
Fine, thank you. We'll ask questions of the panel when you have concluded your testimony. Next witness.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. I'm Katie Garrett. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Family Law Section of the Oregon Department of Justice. But I'm here today as the chair of the Law Commission work group that addressed this project. And my role, Wendy actually summarized basically what this bill does very well and the original intent of it. The original intent was to address the role of putative fathers in juvenile court. putative father is an alleged biological father who hasn't gone through the process of establishing legal paternity. Now, Shani Fuller will speak in a moment about the various ways to establish legal paternity under current law, so I won't go into that in detail. But this bill was originally to address those who had not gone through one of those formal processes, but who may still have some custodial or substantive or even procedural rights in a juvenile court proceeding. Initially, we identified some problems with the current state of the juvenile code and that it doesn't accurately reflect constitutional principles that have been applied to such fathers. And in addition to that, we recognize that as a policy matter, the code doesn't currently include some men who, as a policy matter, should be included to provide resources for their children. So basically what the work group did was come up with a new description of putative fathers who are constitutionally entitled to inclusion and who as a policy matter should be included. And those amendments are set out in the bill. And it also granted the juvenile court with specific authority to address paternity disputes. Currently, the way the code is set up, the juvenile court doesn't have specific authority to address issues of paternity. And due to some recent appellate decisions, the Court of Appeals has made very clear that if the juvenile court doesn't have explicit authority to do something within the juvenile code, then the juvenile court can't address those issues. So we were noticing a lot of slowdowns in the process because issues of paternity would come up in the middle of a juvenile dependency case, and the juvenile court couldn't specifically address those issues. They had to be addressed by a court wearing kind of a different hat. And we also saw, as a result of that, a lot of inconsistency throughout the state in how various juvenile courts and other courts were addressing issues of paternity, all of which were resulting in a slowdown in the process of achieving permanency for kids, which is the goal, in dependency proceedings. So the practical effect of this bill, if passed, is it will get these men before the court early in the proceedings and hopefully will then, because the juvenile court will have authority to resolve the issues, will allow for quicker permanency for kids. I can walk you through the portions of the original Law Commission bill. I don't know if you want that kind of detail at this point or if you would rather just defer for questions.
Thank you.
Okay.
Next witness.
Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, for the record, Ronell Schenkel, legislative liaison to the Attorney General. I believe you have, by the way, written testimony from all four of us already on your desks. My background information on the role of the Child Support Program is repeated there for you, and as this committee has heard it before, I will not put it on the record. I will just say briefly that, as Wendy and Katie have already explained to you, the original focus of this bill on putative fathers and paternity establishment in the juvenile court system is a very important one, and we do support the passage of this bill. As they have also indicated, there were significant amendments put into this bill. I was involved in those amendments, as was Shani Fuller, who will be able to tell you some more technical information on that, along with Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center and a representative from Dads of America, who I believe will be testifying. Briefly, the additional provisions have to do not with paternity establishment, which has been your testimony so far, but paternity disestablishment. As many of you are aware in working with your constituents, there are longstanding laws in Oregon related to paternity, especially when it comes to children born to a marriage. But with the advances in DNA, both the availability and the reliability, the issue of biology versus legality is one that has risen to the forefront. You've heard previous testimony on other bills in this committee on that topic. This is a result of negotiations and compromise coming out of those discussions. You do have a bill before you now that the Senate Judiciary has passed, which meets the needs of all of the players to the best of our ability. There are sunset provisions, as Ms. Johnson has pointed out, that will allow us time to participate in the Law Commission's work group and further analyze this important area of law, but we think it's a reasonable step forward during the next 2 years to take a look at some of these cases and let them play out through the system. So we are here in support, and I will turn it over to Shani to give you a little more detail.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. My name is Shani Fuller, and I'm with the Department of Justice Oregon Child Support Program. As stated by Ms. Schenkel, the Division of Child Support, Department of Justice, is in support of both the putative father provisions and the paternity disestablishment provisions of this bill as amended. Paternity is established in Oregon under four main provisions. There is a conclusive presumption during marriage, a disputable presumption during marriage, filiation proceedings or a court determination that paternity is established, a signed voluntary acknowledgement, which is a process that we have in Oregon law where the parties can sign acknowledging that they are the parents of the child, and an administrative action where we, the child support program, take action and order the parents to show up for DNA testing and order paternity from there. Sometimes the parties do not show up, and those are default actions, and so no blood tests were done. By virtue of the father not showing up, he is defaulted and named the father of that child. Currently, a conclusive presumption cannot be challenged under Oregon law. Disputable presumption, it is not clear under Oregon law how that would be challenged. A default action for paternity or a signed voluntary acknowledgement can be challenged within 1 year. Attached to my testimony, you'll find a summary of the new provisions in sections 9 through 23 of the bill that was prepared by Sybil Hebb of the Oregon Law Center. That is an excellent overview of what this bill does and how it changes paternity law. I will just hit the highlights. It would allow a legal father or a mother to challenge paternity under this law. A voluntary acknowledgement or default, that's the default administrative action, or a default court judgment of paternity, could be challenged within 2 years. And a conclusive presumption entirely goes away, and those are just presumed parents, and so a presumed parent in marriage could be challenged at any time. Generally, if there was no knowledge on the part of the parent that they weren't the actual parent of the child and there is a showing of fraud, the court must make a determination of non-paternity if blood tests show that there is a zero probability that that man is the father. In the absence of fraud, the court will enter a determination of non-paternity if will enter a determination of non-paternity unless it would cause undue harm to the child. So in that scenario, when there is not fraud, the court would be able to look at the circumstances of the child and determine whether it would cause undue harm to that child. We did address child support in this. As Ms. Schenkel explained, the child support program has a significant interest in what happens to the child support obligation. And in this circumstance, it would continue, child support will continue during the pendency of an action unless good cause is shown. And once a determination of non-paternity is entered, the ongoing child support program ongoing child support obligation would terminate and past due support may be satisfied by the court, but it's not automatic. And again, then there is a sunset provision on sections 9 through 23, and the child support program also would be participating in that Oregon Law Commission work group to look at the Uniform Parentage Act and monitoring these cases in the meantime. That's all I have. Thank you.
Good. Thank you all for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee of the panelists? If you throw no questions from us, it's you got one. Okay, you're going to get a B-minus, I guess. Stephen A.
Mr. Chairman, I'm getting a B-minus. I guess I direct this to the Oregon Law Commission. And Section 4 of the bill, relating to parties to proceedings, which would be dependency proceedings, under current law, a putative father can establish that he's a party if he's provided physical and emotional and financial needs in the previous 6 months. I notice that the new proposed language does not contain a six-month period. Could you elaborate on that? What was the reason behind that?
Yes, I can answer that question. The group determined that the limited time constraints in that current statute don't adequately reflect the constitutional principles, which focus more on the relationship that a man has established with a child rather than having a durational component as to when that relationship existed. That was one of the original reasons for changing that. The other one is that there are provisions in Chapter 109 relating to putative fathers that also contains some durational language, and those provisions do not currently match the provisions in the juvenile code, which was one of the things we were attempting to address in this bill. You will notice that's the other statute I was referring to is 109-096, which also is amended by this bill. And 109-096 now specifically excludes juvenile court proceedings. So for the purpose of juvenile court, this statute, 419B875 that you're referring to, will govern the parties in juvenile court proceedings rather than referring back to that 109-096 provision, which included the durational language. But to more directly address your question, I think, the focus of the amendment is on the relationship that a parent either, that a father either has established with the child or who has attempted to establish with the child. And rather than focusing on the time period, we felt it was more appropriate to focus on the nature of the relationship and the efforts that the man had made.
Follow-up question?
Yes.
Chair Myers, committee. You mentioned constitutional standard. Is that set forth in here? Is a case cited by any chance?
Yes. In the report, the report actually goes into fairly significant detail about the U.S. constitutional cases decided on this issue and also the cases in Oregon where the appellate courts have addressed rights of putative fathers.
The putative fathers sub-work group report, is that correct?
I'm sorry, can you repeat your question?
It's the putative father subwork group, for the record.
Yes, the Oregon Law Commission putative father work group report on page 4 goes into the Oregon appellate court's treatment and also the U.S. Supreme Court's treatment of putative fathers in these types of cases.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Do we have further questions from the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that what we have here on disestablishment of paternity is a temporary solution with a sunset and then further work for the work group. What are the issues that are going to be the main point of focus in the Law Commission's work in this two-year period? Maybe Ms. Johnson, maybe you could lead off on that, or maybe Ms. Garrett.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, again for the record, Wendy Johnson with the Oregon Law Commission. The Uniform Parentage Act looks at other issues besides disestablishment of paternity and paternity, but it's an all-inclusive look at paternity issues. And so there may be more time limits on when you can when you can challenge, but trying to make that fairness decision and make the system move smoothly, but yet provide permanency for children as well.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you may.
So I may be misunderstanding what the proposal is in the Senate bill. I thought it was putting in place a sort of a temporary solution on disestablishment of paternity, but with it sort of be that solution being reconsidered then as part of this broader work effort. Am I right so far?
Representative McPherson, yes, you're correct. This
okay.
is a temporary fix.
Okay. And the then what are the, really for anybody in the panel, what are the key points that are sort of open for debate or part of the uncertainty that causes this to be a temporary solution that needs further debate as opposed to a permanent solution?
Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, again for the record, Ron L. Schenkel with the Department of Justice. It was actually the Department of Justice that submitted the proposal to the Oregon Law Commission to ask that they look at the Uniform Paternity Act. That act is a national model but not a mandate for us, and all of the states nationwide are still struggling with this issue. As Ms. Johnson said, the act is a comprehensive look at all areas of paternity, how you establish dissolutions, voluntary acknowledgments, how you disestablish, how you deal with biology, how you move paternity from one man to another. It is very comprehensive. The department did a section-by-section analysis of that act as it compares to current Oregon law, and that's what I believe the Law Commission plans to go through and look at. Where does it differ from Oregon law? Let's talk about that and analyze it. And the reason this is temporary is, as you are well aware, at least from our position in Department of Justice, when we put together laws like this through the legislative process under the timeframes that you have, We fear for unintended consequences. Ultimately, this will impact juvenile courts, as you've heard to a degree today, circuit courts, de novo people filing on their own. And so we would like to get a broader group of people to the table, private sector attorneys, judges, and so on, which I believe the Law Commission can facilitate and make sure we haven't missed any important pieces in this process when we're looking at the interests of families.
One more question.
Yes, you may.
Good. Then if we're going to be taking a comprehensive look over the next 2 years at the whole issue of paternity, then why are we taking up a bill that makes fairly significant changes and there's a lot of content in it now, which is going to sunset in 2 years, if the whole thing is going to be reevaluated in a sort of a broader, under the context or in the context of a broader kind of uniform act proposal?
Chair Ackerman and Representative McPherson, quite honestly, we need some case examples. We need to start working in this area and see how this is going to play out, both for the families and both for the practitioners and the courts. This is going to provide us that opportunity in a limited scope to do so, taking one step forward into this arena and getting some experience in Oregon that we can work from. That's why Ms. Fuller indicated that at least in the child support program, those cases that evolve disestablishment, we'll be able to track and bring that information, so we'll have something to work from other than speculation.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I have a question. I want to make sure I'm on the same page with you folks. The staff summary says that the paternity disestablishment provisions sunset on January 2, 2008. But in Section 23 of the bill, the way I read it, it says these provisions become operative on June 2, 2008. Am I on the right page, Counsel?
Chair, members of the committee, if you look on page 10 at line 16, Section 9 of this 2005 Act is repealed on January 2, 2008.
Okay.
Chair, what I think what you see is how they handle a sunset provision. What you get further on in the section is the amendments of this become operative 2000. In other words, in January 2, 2008, we go back to the current law. From when operative date of this bill, which till 2008, January 2008, what's in Section 9 will be law. And in January 2, 2008, unless we do something, those unamended sections that are at the end of the bill are operative law.
Okay. Everyone seems in agreement with that, and I accept that. Thank you for your help. Further questions to the panel from the committee? Mr. Krieger, you're looking at me, but you're not raising your hand.
Not a question. I just want to thank them for the effort and work that went into it, because it wasn't easy.
Mm-hmm.
I finally had to nickname Ronell Trouble before I got some action.
Thank you. Yes, I want to thank you, too. You made our job much, much easier, and I know that this was a sweeping and complicated process, and your reports, both verbal and written, really assisted us this afternoon or this morning.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
I'll call up the last two witnesses, Matt Minahan, Sybil Hebb. Folks like to come forward, please.
Good morning. Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. My name is Matt Minahan. I'm a lobbyist for Dads America, here today on behalf of Dads America in support of Senate Bill 234, mainly in support of especially in support of the part that deals with the issue of reopening paternity, which is an issue I testified before you in this committee in the form of another bill. And again, we are in support of Senate Bill 234, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center, for the record. And I just want to be respectful of the committee's time and just indicate for the record that the Law Center has been a part of the negotiations and supports the consensus amendments related to the disestablishment of paternity procedures. And we look forward to the work of the Law Commission over the next 2 years to take a further look at this. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Questions from the committee? Again, I want to thank each of you for bringing to us, which was a far-reaching and complicated bill, and I applaud your success in integrating it so well within the current code and working with others. You probably have my vote for the lobbyist of the year because you've done a phenomenal job. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Further testimony for the persons wishing to testify on the Senate Bill 234. Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 234A and open a work session on Senate Bill 234A. Committee?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 234 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that Senate Bill 234A be forwarded to the House with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion from the committee?
Or to the full committee.
Excuse me?
You said the House to the committee.
Full committee.
Oh, yeah, to the full committee. I'm jumping one step ahead and circumventing the full committee and disenfranchising the chair. Sorry.
Got to watch him, Chair.
I got to change my gavel. Put the speed down a little bit and get the job done. Okay, so the motion is to forward Senate Bill 234A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Now do we have discussion? Still none. Okay. You may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Senate Bill 234A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation with Representative Flores as carrier. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 234A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 237A and ask counsel to explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 237A comes to you from, at the request of the Joint Intervention Committee for the Oregon Law Commission. It sets the statute of limitations and employment safety lawsuit at 1 year after the employee or prospective employee has reasonable cause to believe a violation has occurred, applies the cause of actions occurring on or after the effective date of this act, adds an emergency clause. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I'm correctly, I don't think there's a statute of limitations right now on this particular action, so it was ambiguous. I believe the Oregon Law Commission is here on behalf of the bill.
Yes, they are, and in that regard, I'll call back Wendy Johnson as the only witness this morning that signed up. Good morning again. You might tell us what the vote was in the Senate, if anybody remembers.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Wendy Johnson with the Oregon Law Commission. Chair Ackerman, to answer your first question, I believe it was a unanimous vote on this bill. There may have been a number of members absent or excused, but I don't recall any votes against this bill. Just quickly, why this bill is before you. The Oregon Law Commission reviewed the civil rights chapter of the ORS back for the 2001 session, and at that time when that reorganization was done to make the statutes easier to use and work through, a number of substantive issues were spotted, including the fact that a statute of limitations was not in statute for a couple of claims, including this bill before you. The legislature provided a remedy for employees if they are discriminated upon for making a health and safety complaint. Basically a whistleblower provision for OSHA, and so you're allowed to bring a discrimination claim if your employer fires you or does some other discriminatory act because of your filing that complaint. It does not provide in statute, though, how long you have to make that discrimination claim in court. You have a choice of filing with Boley or going into court, and so there's no statute of limitations. As you know, if you're going to provide a right, you need to define a remedy as well as the statute of limitations, and so this bill just simply puts in a statute of limitations. Originally, when we pre-session filed the bill, we put it for 180 days because we were looking for some sort of middle ground, but as we discussed with practitioners more, 180 days is too short to really get in to talk to an attorney and get a case filed, and so the bill, as it was approved by the Judiciary Committee over in the Senate side and then on the floor, was 1 year, which is common for most discrimination claims. It's a very simple bill. All it does is add a one-year statute of limitations for these claims.
Thank you for your testimony and presentation. Questions? Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I recall correctly, I think Boley's statute of limitations, like 300 days to file a claim or something with Boley. And then aren't there other cases within statute that 180 days is applied?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Worth, actually, to file with Boley presently, you have to do it within 30 days of the Discriminatory Act. There is a bill in this session to lengthen the 30 days because 30 days is very short. But most discrimination claims are 1 year.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you may.
And then there's something that was 300 days. Maybe that was through the federal. That's probably through the federal. Well, it's confusing because there are, when I was researching this, but there's so many different timelines and to file a claim since the act last happened, and it's really confusing.
Representative Ackerman and Representative Worth, I know that Marsha Ola Miller from Boley is here. We could explain Boley's statute of limitations, but for the most part, those actions filed in court are 1 year. The length for Boley filings is a little bit different often.
Thank you.
I think, too, there's always some confusion if there's a public employer that would also require a tort claim notice within 180 days. Would that be your view?
That could be.
Okay. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony again.
Thank you.
The further witnesses on Senate Bill 237A. Okay, seeing none, I will close the public hearing on that Senate bill and open a work session on Senate Bill 237A. You have a motion for the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Worth.
That Senate Bill 237 engrossed. Do you move to the full committee with due pass recommendation?
Representative Worth moves that Senate Bill 237A be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Florence?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Werder?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Senate Bill 237A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation with Representative Worth as a carrier. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 237A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 238A. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 238A also comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, clarifies that remedies for volunteer firefighters, and legislators whose employer discriminates against them when requesting a leave of absence as part of their official duties, and for smokers who are discriminated against for their smoking on the job, allows them to seek reinstatement of the back pay.
I have one witness, Ms. Johnson. Would you like to come back? You might as well stay at the panel at this rate.
Thank you, Representative Ackerman and members of the committee. Senate Bill 238 does come to you also from the Oregon Law Commission, again from the Civil Rights Work Group. This problem was also spotted during the original reorganization. There were three discrimination claims that were provided by the legislature in statute, but the remedy was not provided. And most of the discrimination claims are listed in ORS 659A.885, it lists the remedies that the various discrimination claims are entitled to. This is a rather odd cast of characters. It involves members of the legislature who are discriminated against because they are doing their official duties and are away from their jobs. It includes the discrimination of volunteer firefighters who are doing their jobs and are discriminated against by their employer. And lastly, tobacco users who are smoking off hours or using other tobacco products during off hours. The legislature has provided a remedy or a right for each of these discrimination claims, but it's not clear what the remedy is. This bill would provide a remedy, and you have the Law Commission's report explaining the remedies that this bill would provide. For all three of these classes, and Representative Garrett is smiling, when we were over on the House side, the Senate side, the question was asked, well, what if the person is a legislator, a smoker, and a volunteer firefighter? and they're discriminated against. There are different remedies. At the Law Commission, we struggled over what the public policy issue was here and what remedies should be provided. If you look at the list, there's not a lot of reason for some discrimination claims receiving better remedies than some of the others. But briefly, what this bill does is provide opportunity for reinstatement and injunctive relief. So if you were fired, you'd be hired back. It also provides for attorney fees and party costs. And then for the firefighters as well as the legislative members. It also provides for compensatory damages, which would include any pain and suffering or mental anguish, and or $250, whichever is greater. The tobacco users would not get that extra compensatory damages, but otherwise the remedies would be the same.
Thank you. Questions to the witness from the committee? Chair Krieger.
They already hit on it, but that means that Representative Garrard could be a double dipper. Representative Krupp, he's a firefighter, could be a double dipper.
Double
dipping. I think there probably be some
case for double or triple damages.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, this is not my bill.
it may be.
It's a good win.
I have to accomplish that. Okay, further questions for the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Ms. Johnson, I'm confused. I'm just going through the written materials here that the Law Commission submitted, and as you had already observed, this odd combination of three different discrimination claims is so it's just a little hard to kind of figure out what the connection is here. And if I'm absorbing this correctly, on just a quick scan through the written testimony, it looked like there were remedies that were identified as being appropriate for legislators and firefighters, but there was concern about whether it was appropriate for tobacco users. And so those remedies have been removed as to everyone, is that right? Help me understand what's in this written material more fully than I can while I just quickly scan it.
Representative Ackerman, Representative McPherson. Originally when the Law Commission's work group did this bill and pre-session filed it, they went with all of the remedies because we really couldn't reconcile why some discrimination claims got some remedies and some others. So originally all three groups received the injunctive relief, compensatory relief, as well as punitive damages. When the Law Commission reviewed that, they decided that the punitive damages caused a lot of expense on the court system as well as parties, and they didn't see the need in these three cases. So all of them were removed from the subsection 3 of 659A.885. So all of them were removed from that. To make a compromise, the Law Commission recommended that for the other two categories, the firefighters and the legislators, they would be added to little subsection 4, which adds the compensatory damages piece. In the report, it explains what the three remedies were, which would include a right to a jury trial as well as punitive damages. None of the groups would receive those damages.
Okay. What's the law now? Are there any of these remedies? There are no remedies specified today now, is that right?
Representative Pearson, that's correct. And so a court might find that only the injunctive relief is available, or they could find everything is available, including punitives. It's just not clear, and so it would have to be litigated.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, thank you, Mr.
Chair. Okay, yes, so thank you. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you.
You're excused. Any further witnesses on Senate Bill 238, please come forward. Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 238A and open a work session on Senate Bill 238A. Motion?
Mr. Chair, I got to carry this one. I would move Senate Bill 238A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard moves that Senate Bill 238A move to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion from the committee? See no discussion. Please call the roll.
Representative Ford?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Senate Bill 238A will be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation with Representative Garrard as carrier. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 238A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 330A. Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 330A comes to you from the Joint and Judiciary Committee. It allows a reporter employed by a party to a court proceeding to charge a fee as agreed to by the parties continues at $2.50 cap per page a reporter may charge a public body.
Thank you. I believe I have two witnesses, Laura Smith and Mary Fagan. Please come forward. Morning.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. I'm Laura Smith with Dave Barrows and Associates here today on behalf of the Oregon Court Reporters Association. And I have with me today the legislative chair of that association, Ms. Mary Fagan. She's an official court reporter here in Marion County. And she's going to talk to you a little bit about 338 today.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. As Laura stated, my name is Mary Fagan, and I'm an official court reporter here in Marion County, and I'm also the legislative chair for the Oregon Court Reporters Association. Historically, official court reporters who are state employees have been the guardians of the record in Oregon's courtrooms. Due to budget cuts in recent years, the majority of those official court reporters have either resigned their positions or been let go. And so now there are currently about 12 court reporters throughout the entire state. In most of the courtrooms now, either analog audio or digital audio is being utilized to record the proceedings. We've got documented cases where problems have happened with some major cases, particularly of note here in Marion County, the Northwest Steelheaders case, a five-day civil trial, where only 2 days of the 5 days was recorded. That case ended up in a retrial. Also, other documented cases involving problems with audio on murder cases out of Clackamas County. A lot of these problems have prompted attorneys to hire their own freelance court reporter to come into the courtroom on their cases, predominantly on civil cases. And there is no cost to the state on this, and they have utilized those reporters for going ahead and using their record during the proceedings and or also having them type up audio tapes for the appellate transcripts. The statutes that currently set the transcript rate at $2.50 a page for the original, 25 cents per page for a copy, covers whether that transcript is completed by either an official court reporter or a freelance court reporter when they are hired by an attorney. Court reporting firm owners who receive these requests to transcribe cases on appeal or report to court proceedings, the statutory rates do not allow them to pay their court reporters the amount that these reporters are normally accustomed to receiving, much less pay their office overhead and their taxes. What SB 330A would then allow would be to have the freelance court reporters negotiate with all parties to a proceeding to charge the an appellate transcript rate that they would agree upon. And it would also require these freelance court reporters to follow the appellate transcript guidelines that are set by the Supreme Court. The Oregon Court Reporters Association strongly believes that the change in the circumstances in the Oregon courtrooms here require that the principles of a free market economy prevail. And we strongly support that this bill be moved out of committee with a recommendation for passage.
Thank you. Further testimony from either of you?
I'd just like to clarify, Mr. Chair, that this does not have a fiscal impact on the state. We made sure that any official court reporter would still be reporting at the 250 rate. The other rate would be negotiated between a private attorney and a private freelance reporter. So no fiscal impact on the state.
Fine. Thank you. Questions? Representative Garrard?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm unclear. What happens if you don't get the agreement of all of the parties involved? I know the bill references that as to what the recorder could charge, but the bill says if all parties agree. What happens if they don't all agree?
Can we have just a minute, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, There's two bills that come from the Oregon Court Reporters Association. In 331, all parties have to agree that that would be the official record. At this point, it would just be the parties that agree to pay the freelance attorney or the freelance court reporter. It would be the negotiations between those parties who do have a contract with the court reporter. If there were two parties that wanted to contract with them, they would do a separate negotiated contract, would be my understanding. Is that correct?
I believe so. And if I can also state what I know that we have happened in Marion County, because we only have 2.5 officials for the 14 judges, several freelance reporters have been brought in. If a party did not agree, then actually they ran the audio. The reporter was there, the freelance reporter was there to provide the services, either excerpts of transcripts or provide a separate copy, but not the official record to the party that hired this reporter to come in. But otherwise, the audio was the official record.
Thank you.
Counsel. Chair, members of the committee, in looking at the bill in line 12, it says, except as provided in subsection 3 of this section, a reporter employed by one of the parties may charge a fee. And then it sets up a process whereby the parties may agree. Now, my assumption is that parties don't agree, then the report is brought in by one of the parties, they will use that reporter, then the other party will either get their own or go without. And if the case is worth anything, I can't imagine one party having a court reporter and the other one not. I mean, in fact, I think for the lawyer involved in that, that could be malpractice.
Thank you, counsel. Further questions for the committee? Seeing none, then, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thanks.
Any further witnesses on Senate Bill 330A? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 338 and open a work session on Senate Bill 330A. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 330A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that Senate Bill 330A be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion from the committee? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Senate Bill 330A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, with Representative Flores as carrier, and I'll close the work session on that bill and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 645A. Counsel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 645A comes to you from Senator Metzger, and it creates a statutory framework for the regulation of structured settlement agreements in Oregon. It's based on the model state structured settlement agreement. To chair members of the committee, this is oftentimes used in a situation where someone has had, as part of a negotiation of a negligence claim, a payment paid over time. And for some reason, they'd like to get the money right away. It could also happen if someone were to win the lottery and originally decides to take the payment over time and then want to get paid right away. There are companies that are fairly well regulated that will buy your settlement, your agreement, for whatever amount of money you agree to. And this would set forth the regulation in Oregon for that.
Thank you, counsel. We have one witness, Paul Cosgrove. Please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the National Association of Settlement Purchasers. The bill before you, as counsel has described, is a model act. And I just want to open by saying that this is a bill that has been passed in this form in about 35 states and in a similar form in about 4 or 5 others as of this point, so Oregon's a little bit behind the curve. Structured settlement payments are commonly used in personal injury claims and in workers' compensation claims, sometimes because of the fact that the injured person is a minor and it seems more prudent to have some of the payments come over time through the minor's life, partly because sometimes it's anticipated there will be future expenses that need to be paid, and the money should be paid out at the time that it's estimated those future expenses will occur. But those estimates, which are made at the time the case is settled, and these are all involved in settlements between the parties, may turn out to be incorrect or inappropriate, and there may be need to access some or all of those future payment streams in an earlier time to pay for unanticipated expenses. This model act was developed through the National Coalition or National Conference of Insurance Legislators. It's a subset of the National Conference of State Legislators that deals with insurance matters, and it has been endorsed by the National Association of Settlement Purchasers, my client, the National Association of Structured Settlement Payments, the people who actually have the annuity policies, and by a variety of attorneys and consumer groups across the nation. Here in Oregon, when we first drafted the model, we circulated around to all the insurers, the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and every other interested party we could think of, and we've either received support or no opposition to the bill from all of those interested parties. I'd be happy to answer any questions. It might be helpful if I could explain using an example of how structured settlements work and how this might be appropriate. This comes from a friend of my family who is a man who spent his first 40 years of his life in Fairview Training Center. And when that facility was closed, he went out on his own and received some support from the state to set up in an apartment and received a job at a sheltered workshop at Wacker Siltronic. He went to work very early in the morning, and one morning when it was dark, he was walking to his bus and tripped over an extension cord that a homeowner had run from their house to a travel trailer out in front of their house across the sidewalk. He's a rather heavy man. He fell hard, and he shattered his arms and was unable to work. As part of the settlement of that case, there was a payment of a lump sum at the beginning of the case, and this is sort of a typical process that allowed him to purchase a small condominium to cover his housing costs in the future. And then payments were structured over time, both in terms of his future medical expenses and living expenses that were estimated to be needed to be paid, plus also taking into account eventually he would be old enough to have Social Security, and then the payments would be reduced to take into account that. That is a typical situation with a structured settlement payment. It's individually negotiated to try to cover the person's needs. But as I mentioned in the beginning, sometimes those well-anticipated negotiations turn out to be not fitting the reality, and that's where this bill comes into play, where additional funds are needed, and so the payment stream or a portion of the payment stream needs to be sold. The bill provides for very detailed disclosures to the person, a 3-day right of rescission if once they sign the agreement. It provides for a petition to the court with notice to all parties, all interested parties, and the court must make findings that, in fact, this is in the best interest of the person and that they've received independent legal and tax accounting advice before the agreement is authorized, and then and only then is the agreement effective. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Gerard.
Mr. Cosgrove, to make sure that I understand the bill, could you go through the bill line by line and explain? That's a joke, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry. Mr. Cosgrove was asked to do that during the Senate hearings, and so I wanted to make sure he was treated fairly on this side.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gerard and I had a brief conversation before the hearing today, and this bill on the Senate side had been set on a very, very busy agenda with lots of witnesses on lots of bills, and I had approached the chair asking if we might be able to be moved up in the order to be in and out relatively quickly, and made a wager with Mr. Taylor, not a monetary wager, that we might be able to get the bill out very quickly. And in response to that, one of the members who'd heard about that bet had asked me to do a line-by-line explanation of the bill, to which I replied that every line on every page is an excellent example of good drafting and sound public policy.
Thank you. Further questions? I have one, and that is I want to assume that the award that's going to be converted into the structured payment has tax consequences. In other words, it might be a portion of a personal injury claim that has a significant amount of lost wages or might contain non-economic damages, which under some theory could be taxable. If that amount is reduced to the present value and paid out in monthly and structured payments. What disclosures were made to the parties regarding the tax consequences of getting into this type of a structured payout?
Mr. Chairman, you are correct that in most cases the structured settlement payments, even in the cases in which the payments have a built-in escalator or inflationary clause, are determined by IRS in general to be non-taxable. There is a revenue ruling to that regard. That's why the bill has in it the requirement that the court must find that the individual party has had independent tax and legal advice in order to determine whether this change will have an effect on the tax status. I'm not sure I'm competent to tell you in all circumstances whether the changes will or will not have a tax consequence, but that's why the bill built in that process and procedure.
So it's as I think where you are is the top of page 4, where the payee has been advised to seek advice from attorney or accountant, etc. But they can also waive that advice in writing. Is that where that your answer?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So there's no disclosure then by the company that's structuring the payment as to what the tax consequences may be to the payee, self-executing rather than...
Mr. Chairman, the company that's purchasing the payments may not be in a position to know the answer to that question. That's why the advice is to seek independent counsel who can look at the structured settlement, the settlement of the case, and the whole settlement of the case, the structured settlement piece of the case, and make that determination based on the individual's tax situation.
Okay, thank you very much. Further questions? There are no further questions. Thank you very much for
thank
your
Mr.
presentation.
Chairman.
Are there further witnesses on Senate Bill 645A. Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 645A and open a work session on Senate Bill 645A. Motion. Chair will move that Senate Bill 645A be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee. Seeing no discussion, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Wood?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Senate Bill 645A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. I will be the carrier. Close the work session on Senate Bill 645A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 953. Counsel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 953 comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary, includes personal information about a potential actual donor to the Oregon Health Science University with a current exemption for similar information concerning potential actual donors to the Oregon University System. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, can direct your attention to page 4 of the bill, lines 12 through basically 18, which are of where the changes are made. What I want to point out is under current law, the Oregon Health Science University has an exception here to public disclosure, but as it's written, and if taken literally, would mean that personal information that the university sends back to a donor is exempt, but what the donor sends the university is not. And that appears to be an anomaly in the statute, because if you look below it, the Oregon University System has an exemption for personal information, and I believe Mr. Boringer is here from OSHU and can elaborate further.
I'm sure he will. Please come forward, gentlemen. I guess we got one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Beringer, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for OHSU, and I just want to thank you for giving us an opportunity to testify on 953. Council did a nice job of summing up the bill. I'll give you just a little bit of additional background, and then we'll get out of your hair. OHSU and the Oregon University System currently have exemptions to the public records law that allow the universities to protect information about persons who may want to donate money or property to the institutions anonymously. OHSU's exemption was created in 1995 when we were spun off as a public corporation, and the OUS exemption was created just last session. 953 is truly a housekeeping amendment that would modify OHSU's public records exemption relating to donors and combine it into the OUS section. OHSU and OAUS have the same strategic interest in being able to guard the privacy of persons who may want to donate money or property to the university but wish to do so anonymously. If for some reason a potential donor does not want to publicly want the publicity attached to a donation, it is the state's, the university's, and the public's best interest to allow the university to decline to disclose personal information in such cases. The last thing we want to do in this tight fiscal environment is erect barriers that could potentially hinder or prevent outside donations to our universities. While currently both the university system and OHSU provisions on the subject seek the same end, the OUS provision, as council mentioned, is actually better. I want to just close by saying that the list of exemptions under ORS 192.501 is already very long, and with Senate Bill 953, we have an opportunity to shorten that list. It is to everyone's advantage to consolidate exemptions where there is no reason for having different language when the intent and the goal of the sections are the same. Just add that on the Senate side, we checked in with ACLU and the newspaper publishers. Both groups were okay. Thank you again, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions from the committee? Seeing none, well done. Thank you very much. Further witnesses on Senate Bill 953? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 953 and open a work session on Senate Bill 953.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
move Senate Bill 953 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Worth moves that Senate Bill 953 be forwarded to the full committee with the due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee? Seeing none, the clerk can call a roll, please.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Senate Bill 953 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation with Representative Worth as a carrier. And I'll close the work session on that bill. Further business to come before the subcommittee.
Chair, members of the committee, all these bills are already on the schedule for Friday morning.
Thank you, Council.
We were anticipating that they would all go through.
Thank you.
Also, it's easier to take them off than add them after 48 hours.
Okay. Appreciate that. Any further business before the committee? If not, we are adjourned. Record time.